And tonight on Coast to Coast, the 2012 trilogy, and beginning this hour with Robert Gleason, author of Apocalypse 2012. Robert Gleason was born in Michigan City, Indiana. He has an AB in English Literature from Indiana State University, a master's degree in English from the University of Wisconsin, and he has worked in New York Book Publishing as an acquisitions editor pretty much forever. His authors have included the great late science fiction writer Robert Heinlein. He has worked for Simon & Schuster Pocket Books, and for the last 27 years has worked at Tor Forge Books, where he is the executive editor. And he works with such great writers as Whitley Strieber, Larry Niven, Jerry Purnell, Bill Burns. And I'm not going to say great writer, but you do work with me too, Bob.
I sure do. I'll say it. George Neary is a great writer.
Yeah, that's because I learned from you.
I tell you, the new book coming up is going to literally raise the dead. That's true. I'm not joking about that.
With Rosemary Ellen Guiley. That's exciting.
Yep.
Robert, Apocalypse 2000. Tell me, how did you get interested in 2012 in the Mayan calendar?
I wrote an apocalyptic novel. It was a national bestseller called Wrath of God, and it was post-apocalyptic. And I've always had, goes back, I was always fascinated by the Book of Revelation. And, I think that in many respects, Homo sapiens has a self-destructive urge in it that's really hard to understand. I don't understand it. When you think about it, over the last 75 years, as we've gotten smarter and technology's gotten better, we've actually moved closer to the possibility of extinction. And it's always frightened me. And of course, there's all kinds of natural disasters out there.
Oh, sure.
I think, you know, it's terribly important to warn people so they can prepare and attempt to prevent. I think it's a terribly important subject, and also I must say I find it fascinating.
Is Apocalypse 2012 fiction or nonfiction?
Oh, it's a novel, but however we go back to the reign of Quetzalcoatl, the god king, 1,000 years ago, during which he finalized the long count calendar, and he has in the novel this great prophecy which is being recorded. And then in the current period, we have some scientists, the president, and a couple of women archaeologists who are uncovering pieces of Quetzalcoatl's revelation down in Mexico, while narco drug lords are trying to kill them and steal it from them because it's invaluable. It's worth a lot of money. And the disasters that we dramatize in the book to the best of our knowledge, what the ancient, and they were actually Toltecs. Quetzalcoatl was a Toltec.
Yeah.
And the events we describe and what was going on then is factually accurate to the best, given the fact that, to the best available sources.
You call this Apocalypse 2012, which leads me to believe that we could be in for some problems in 2012. Do you feel that?
Well, it is certainly ironic. People talk about, that 11:11 p.m. Universal Time, that December 21st, 2012, they talk about it as being the end of the long count calendar. It's actually the end date of all five long count calendars. And John Major Jenkins pointed out, it began 26,000 years ago when the solar system was aligned with the core of the Milky Way, and it takes another 26,000 years for that to happen, and it happens again. And this is really an odd coincidence. Also, there are so many potential disasters, both natural and man-made, that are they really are becoming more pressing, and we really don't do a great deal about them. And even if they don't happen on 2012, these are ticking time bombs. They will happen one day.
Absolutely, and they seem to be happening though quicker and quicker and quicker.
There's websites that monitor the bulge, under the Yellowstone super volcano.
The caldera there.
And it's 35 miles by 45 miles. It's unlike most volcanoes, it's an inverted cone, you know, that gets bigger. And 640,000 years ago, it blew, and it, you know, it killed half the life on the planet, practically. It was all horrible. And the thing is bulging. It's levitating every year. It gets hotter and hotter. And, you know, we really don't study it adequately. And there's always, you know, that we have an asteroid. We talk about this Apophis asteroid, which in 2029 swings by the Earth. I think it's 18,000 miles. And then, however, in 2036, it comes back. And
Too close.
Yeah, they say it has a 1/5500 chance of hitting the Earth. And as I was talking to Tom earlier, that's crazy that you can't say that, given the scope and the duration of the orbit, given the fact we don't know what it's made of, given the fact it's going to swing very close to the sun, then it's going to swing closer to the Earth than anything in the history of Homo sapiens. You know, that the gravity pull, that's in 2029, the gravity pull will degrade its orbit, as the sun's gravity pull will. We really don't know. And it could very easily, it's too close to call, it could very easily hit the Earth in 2036. And there is something we could do about it. In 2013, it gets within 9 million miles of the Earth. We could mount a mission, go attach a transponder to it, and then we could monitor its approach in 2036 with extreme accuracy. And we would know whether we have to send a mission out to deflect it out of its orbit so it'll miss the Earth. Right now, it's coming so close, we could very easily deflect it into the Earth's orbit.
Absolutely.
Which is why you can't do it.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of that stuff, coming up. And I think the thing I love about 2012, one of the many things is, aside from the fact it's fascinating, is that it's kind of the story of 2012 is a cautionary tale. You know, it's warning us there's a whole lot of stuff out there that we could be doing something about.
As you researched your work for Apocalypse 2012, and I know how thorough you are, Bob, because I would see my red markings on my draft of my books. Did you come across anything that would lead you to believe that whatever the Mayans knew might have been either supernatural or extraterrestrial?
Oh, yeah. There's so much. You know, there's a glyph that shows the shape of the Milky Way as a disk. They knew the Milky Way was a spiraling disk and that we were on the edge of it.
How would they know that?
How would they know? You can't deduce or infer that from the mathematics or even the science. As you said, it would have to be some kind of supernatural revelation or somebody that knew this told them.
Yes.
And there's a whole lot of that stuff that how they came to these insights, thousands of years before, you know, Western civilization, it really is mind boggling. And, they had to have, if it wasn't through extraterrestrials, they had to have a gift of prophecy that is really transcendent. That's something unlike, you'd have to wait till Einstein or something to have somebody that was capable. And furthermore, it was believed. It became literally part of their language, and it was passed on through the generations.
What about the possibilities that Quetzalcoatl might have been in E.T.?
Well, Quetzalcoatl is really, I've often said, and we depict him, he's one of the major characters in the novel, Apocalypse 2012, that Quetzalcoatl was a combination of Alexander the Great, Pericles, who created the great golden city of Athens and brought in all the great scientists and mathematicians and philosophers and writers, and then Jesus Christ in the end. He was unique. The Mayan, he was a Toltec. The Mayan, Toltec, Aztec culture, as you know, they were horrendously bloodthirsty. They made a religion out of human sacrifice.
True.
And to have, and the last thing, during the last part of his reign, Quetzalcoatl outlawed human sacrifice and outlawed these sacrificial wars, the point of which was to gather up prisoners to sacrifice. And of course, the Toltec priesthood rose up against them, and they were going through tremendous global warming, tremendous drought, and the drought. The priests and some of the populace blamed it on Quetzalcoatl for outlawing human sacrifice and outlawing war. And they had a civil war, and he's forced to go into exile. So he becomes a Christ figure at the end. He is a God of compassion. And when you look at the other three major Aztec, Toltec, Mayan deities, they bear a very strong resemblance to three of the four horsemen of the apocalypse. I mean, the fourth horseman, the pale horseman.
Pale horseman, yeah.
He doesn't bring famine or war or pestilence. There's three others that do that. What he brings is hell. You know, the line goes in hell, and hell followed with him, as they said in Revelation. Tetzalcoatlipoca, also, that's what he does. He brings hell. When our world is destroyed on 2012, Tetzalcoatlipoca comes through opens the gates to the underworld road, and he sends all the demons in the Mayan hell to scorch and scourge the earth, which is predicted. We are predicted by the calendars to die by fire, of course.
What happened to this civilization?
But Quetzalcoatl was completely unique. He's a god of compassion. And to answer your question, where does that come from? You know, it certainly didn't come from anything in their culture.
No.
In their religion. Where did it come from? The explanation for Jesus Christ is he's the Son of God. How do you explain Quetzalcoatl? There is no loving God.
There's no
loving God in the Mayan religion. If somebody came up to me and said, I think, you know, Quetzalcoatl, you know, was inspired by extraterrestrials, I wouldn't argue with it.
No, you can't doubt that. Yeah. You can't doubt that at all. Where'd they all go? What happened to the Mayan civilization?
Well, that's, of course, the Toltecs. They suffered. Well, one of the many things that's fascinating about, you know, their history was that they were subject to great cultural and even physical extinction.
Yes.
And I think that's part of what drove the five ages that are recorded in the Aztec sunstone, that we know four of them, you know, those ages ended horribly and violently and terminally for Homo sapiens. Then there is no sixth age, by the way. There's nothing in the Mayan religion that indicates there's going to be a sixth age. But I think part of that was that their croplands were marginal, and they were more dependent on a single crop than any culture, any civilization in the history of the world. And it was maize. They were 100% dependent on it for their sustenance. The rest of there were little things, but they didn't really add. They didn't come to that much. They weren't 1% of their sustenance. And when drought would hit, they suffered horrendously. And, you know, instead of trying to improve their irrigation, and they knew irrigation, they knew about aqueducts and crop diversification, instead they just, you know, sacrificed more people to the gods. But they suffered all the same problems we did. Global warming, drought, but people don't talk enough about the effects of drought worldwide, which is one of the big causes for all the wildfires in the Amazon rainforest.
And will soon be the big cause for more wars.
Yeah. And, you know, our own ability to genetically engineer horrible viruses, which, you remember, one of the four horsemen was pestilence, plague. They also suffered, you know, religious wars. That they had a priesthood that, you know, it was kind of like Al Qaeda or something. You know, they really demanded sacrifice. You know, just like we have suicide bombers, they demanded human sacrifice. You go up onto the top of a mountain, you know, and have your heart cut out. And your head hacked off.
Yeah.
And in the case of Quetzalcoatl, he resisted that, and it caused a horrendous civil war, which which forced him, you know, to take off on a boat, allegedly across the Atlantic.
He lost that battle, didn't he?
Well, there was, if he stayed to fight, you know, they would have killed each other off like the Ginger Tom and the Calico Cat. And he figured the best way he could end the Civil War was to leave. And he did go out he was called the God King. He was believed, that king was believed to be the incarnation of Quetzalcoatl. One of the reasons that the Mexican people, the indigenous Mexicans, that they adopted Christianity with such passion and such commitment was there are some similarities, mm-hmm. that there is something genuinely Christ-like about Quetzalcoatl. And he's the only deity that really liked people. And he really cared. He was kind of a patron saint.
Could he have been the reincarnated Jesus?
There's certainly a lot of similarities between him. And as we said before, where did he come from? There's nothing in the culture or the religion to produce a Quetzalcoatl.
Right.
There is a lot to produce Jesus in the Old Testament. When you read the Old Testament prophets, and this is unique. This is Judaism's unique and wonderful contribution to the world. They gave us morality. They said, the Old Testament prophets said that anybody, it doesn't matter whether you're a king or a slave, you can be called to account before the bar of God's justice. You're not allowed to behave in an unjust way. Of course, they'd run into hiding, you know, immediately after they said it, because those kings would cut you up into 1,000 pieces. But Jesus picks that up, and he drives that message with incredible urgency, so much so that it rocks the world to this day. And, you know, Quetzalcoatl had some of that in him, too. It was really, he did. He was certainly following in Quetzalcoatl's and Jesus' steps.
But there was no tracking of his birth, though, was there, of Quetzalcoatl? He just seemed to appear?
No, he was, his father had been a conqueror. And Quetzalcoatl starts out conquering and taking over a lot of the Mayan cities were nearby. And the Mayans had a dying civilization, but they still had some great architects, sure. Astronomers and mathematicians. He grabbed up all those, and this was his Quetzalcoatl second phase. He took them to the city of Tula, which became the most magnificent city on Earth at that time. And he built all these great temples, and that he produced, he finalized the long count calendar, and it became a golden age. They had a break in the weather, and the crops were producing, humongous ears of corn. This is all actually recorded.
Everything was going his way.
Yeah, and then he outlawed human sacrifice and sacrificial wars, and the drought hit, and then, things went, and the priests, of course, blamed everything on Quetzalcoatl for being a good guy.
He was stuck between a rock and a hard place when all that happened, and he had to flee.
Yeah.
As you were talking earlier, the Mayans truly had an incredible knowledge of celestial solar events and astronomical events as well. And then we get back to, how did they know?
Yeah, well, that's very good, because among other things, that the stars in the sky to them were gods. They were star gods. When they looked at Venus was closely associated with Quetzalcoatl. A lot of them would say there's Quetzalcoatl up there. And now there's a tradition, by the way, that the god of the evil god, referred to him as the black god. He would have been their black horseman of the apocalypse. He's the one, but in his case, hell, he unleashes the legions of hell on Earth on 2012. He was Tetzalcoatlipoca. And there is one tradition where he displaced Quetzalcoatl from heaven, knocked him out of heaven, and Quetzalcoatl comes down to Earth, and he befriends Homo sapiens. He befriends humankind. That's also a tradition.
Robert, we're going to take phone calls with you when we come right back. Our special guest this hour, Robert Gleason, Apocalypse 2012. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. We're with Robert Gleason, author of Apocalypse 2012. We'll take your calls in just a second. But first, Bob, let's talk a little bit more about the ET connection. Because, of course, especially with this program, Bob, we are fascinated by the belief that this planet has been, was visited, and continues to be. And I can only imagine the Mayan culture at the time, visited for some reason by ETs and given some incredible knowledge.
Well, the Mayan people and the whole Mayan Aztec Toltec culture, they believed in extraterrestrials more passionately than any people in world history. The gods to them were star gods. And as the old Hermetic philosopher said, as above, so below, they believed that totally, implicitly. The reason the shaman studied the stars was to figure out what was happening on Earth. If a Mayan had a problem in his or her marriage, they'd go to the shaman would look at the stars and say, the gods are telling you to do this, this. They had a ceremonial calendar called the Chokin that was directed toward that. And they believed that beings from space had not only communicated with them, controlled everything in their lives. And this was a big population of extraterrestrial beings. Also, they were literal. The stars to them were literal gods.
That is fascinating. Let's take some calls. Gina, driving around in Georgia. Hello, Gina. Welcome to the show.
Hi, George. Thanks for taking my call. Sure, I love your show. I listen to you all the time.
Thank you.
Hi, Gina.
Hello, Bob. I love what you're talking about, Bob. I have a different take. I've recently been writing my own book, Spiritually Inspired. I believe that as far as Revelations is concerned, that rather than a prophetic document, I believe that that's a historical document that's been carried through from each time that we've gone through this sort of like destruction stage and age of development. And to kind of give you an idea of what I'm saying, you know, Jesus Christ talked about the tares and the wheat. I believe that what he's talking about is a certain species that's more of like a controlling creator.
Could you repeat that again? I couldn't quite hear it.
I said, when Jesus Christ talks about the tares in the wheat, I believe that what he's talking about is a separate species, more of like a controlling creator, or perhaps another species that has been a part of the creation of our planet and been a part of what has been, you know, growth steps-wise for all of us throughout the ages. But I believe that, you know, there's cosmic events that cause, you know, every so many thousands of years that bring us to this point where, you know, the fear factor steps in. And I believe that Revelations is more of a historical reference. In other words, I think we're recreating this over and over and over. And Revelations is there to try and tell us once again, no, kids, you don't have to destroy each other. You don't have to destroy the planet. You don't have to be fearful of other species. You have to be more fearful of your own behavior.
Well, certainly it is really quite interesting, as you know, that the prediction of Revelation is that there's a pitched battle between a so-called angel and Satan, and Satan's contained for 1,000 years. But then after that 1,000 years, there's this horrendous battle on the plains of Armageddon in Judea. And I've pointed out from time to time that would have begun in 1012. And there were actually events. For instance, I know some people, I'm not arguing this is true at all, but I know some people, you know, are convinced that a nuclear armed Al Qaeda, you know, could foment nuclear destruction, which could be parlayed into global destruction. I've seen scenarios that take a half a dozen nuclear strikes and those are parlayed into a pretty much of a global nuclear holocaust. Some people are very, very much afraid of this. Well, in 1012, there was actually an Egyptian caliph that ran most of the Middle East named Caliph Al-Hakim, who declared in Jerusalem war on Christianity and Judaism, and he leveled the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which was said to have been built upon Golgotha, the hill of skulls where Christ was crucified, and was said to contain Christ's sepulchre, which was why they called it the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And that is what sparked the Crusades, which was the attempt to contain, you know, Islam, and which has gone on for 1,000 years. It never really quite ended. And the 1,000 years would be up, marked by, you know, Caliph Al-Hakim, that his actions culminated in 1012, that 1,000 years later it would be 2012.
Absolutely. Isn't it true, Bob, that most civilizations have always thought that their era would end with an apocalypse?
That's absolutely true. That all civilizations have as part of their religion and their mythology a Genesis myth and an end time myth. They also all have hell worlds. In fact, the Buddhists, for instance, have thousands of hell worlds. And very frequently that apocalypse, that end times, is intermingled with the hell world. And in Revelation, of course, you know, a lot of humanity ends up in hell.
Let's go to Sacramento. First-time caller, Jonah, you're on with Bob Leeson on Coast to Coast. Hi, Jonah.
Good evening, fellas, gentlemen. Very good show, as always, George. Thank you.
Sure.
I had a question about Quetzalcoatl, and I was wondering if you had ever heard of him actually being similar to Christ in the sense that they were heard many years beyond their days, but more in aspects in tune with Lucifer. And the higher density that they arise from or descend from, if you will, the Bible says they fell. And I was wondering if you ever heard anything like that.
The God that is most identified with the Mexican people is really Quetzalcoatl, and for instance, the closest you'd get to Lucifer would be Tezcatlipoca, who is the black god, and he's the one that unleashes the forces of hell on Earth on 2012. And his primary concern seems to be to really hurt humanity very, very badly. I don't think he was interested in, you know, Lucifer kind of seduces humankind. Mm-hmm. That's his great. Lucifer was an angel of light. He was the most beautiful angel in heaven, according to the tradition. And a Persian tradition has he was the angel that loved God the most. And when God placed Adam and Eve above the angels, including Lucifer, he couldn't tolerate it. But his great strength is his attractiveness, his seductiveness. There was nothing attractive and seductive about Tezcatlipoca.
At all?
No. You would not have liked him at all, nor would he have attempted to seduce you.
Was he loved by his own?
Quetzalcoatl? Oh, he was profoundly loved. I mean, the great Mayan temple, you know, Chichen Itza, you know, has the temple of Kukulkan, which was another name for Quetzalcoatl. Yeah, he is he's still revered. You and I were talking once, and that you met some fabulous, you know, Mexican friends of mine. They're just the finest people you meet, and you wonder where that comes from, where that incredible decency, the love of extended family. It certainly doesn't come out of the Mayan religion, except for Quetzalcoatl. And one of the reasons I think they adopted Christianity so passionately was I think they somehow in their minds they equated Christ with Quetzalcoatl.
Fascinating. Next up, let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hello there.
Hey, it's Whitley.
Whitley. How you doing?
There he is.
How you doing?
Well, I'm fine. Thank you, both gentlemen. And I have been listening in, and I am... You know, I was thinking about Quetzalcoatl, Moses, Akhenaten, Osiris, and Jesus, all with the same message.
Yeah. Yep.
All appearing within about 1,000 years of each other.
Yeah.
All of them, basically, except for Moses, in terrible trouble because of the message.
Absolutely. You know, Whitley, I was just thinking that message, that, you know, Christ's message and Quetzalcoatl's message, you don't find it, you know, in the Bhagavad Gita. You do not find it in Plato's Republic. You don't find it in the conversations of Buddha.
No.
That you do find it in the Old Testament, you know, prophets. And it is a unique, everything we know about morality, we really learned from the Old Testament prophets and from Jesus Christ, not from the other great philosophers.
Right, exactly. And I, by the way, folks, Bob is also my editor, and George knows so well, he's George's editor. He is strict taskmaster.
Oh my gosh, we were talking about his red flared pen, Whitley.
Oh yes, the Red, I don't get red pen stuff. I get emails.
By the way, Whitley, if there are, I noticed Gina said that she was interested in writing. If there are listeners out there that are interested in writing, I actually just a couple of days ago set up my first website. It's robertgleason2012.com, and I will have a page in probably within about 10 days about frequently asked questions about book publishing. There will be a blog with 2012 questions and answers, and hopefully, Whitley, I can get you and George and maybe Bill Burns to occasionally blog on it.
Oh, sure. I'll be glad.
That'd
to.
Be great. Yeah. Hey, yeah. Whitley, keep in touch. I need to talk to you about your event. I'll give you a call in a couple days.
Okay, great.
All right, thanks. Whitley Strieber, great author. And, of course, you just mentioned my partner Bill Burns, who's also one of the stars of the History Channel's UFO Hunters, and here he is. Hi, Bill.
Hi, George. Hi, Bob. Good to see you.
Bill, hi.
Hi, Bob. How are you?
Pretty good. Well, I'm a lot better now that you called up.
Okay, well, that's great. One of the questions that I've always been fascinated by when it came to 2012 and the whole nature of the Mayan prophecies and what happened, I think the big question is, did the Maya have to have a scientific reason for their belief in the 2012 apocalypse?
Well, that's a good question. George and I were talking earlier about where they got these phenomenal insights. 2012 is, of course, it's not simply the final day of the long count calendar. It's the culmination of five long count calendars because, the first day, the Earth was aligned with the heart of the Milky Way, which the Mayans believed that was the heart of hell. We now know, curiously, that it goes through the constellation we call Sagittarius, and at the heart of our galaxy is a super massive black hole that eats stars and also, curiously enough, creates galaxies. We now pretty much most astrophysicists believe that probably every galaxy has a super massive black hole at its heart, and on the first day of the first of the five long count calendars, the Earth was perfectly aligned with that supermassive black hole. And on the last day of December 21st, 2012, it'll be the first time in 26,000 years it's aligned again. You know, where they got, and we know they saw the galaxy as a spinning disk. We have a Mayan glyph that shows that. And that where they got those insights, it had to be, that somebody smarter and wiser had to convey them to them, which would have been extraterrestrial, or that they were just the greatest, they had revelation beyond, supernatural revelation that none of us can even imagine.
Super. Bill Burns, how have you been?
I've been fine. We've been working very hard. We were just, I'm actually in California this evening because we are wrapping up the final shoot days for season 3 of UFO Hunters. So that's what I've been doing for the
past. It's been a great show, Bill, and I can't tell you how many people have called this program commenting on the incredible episodes that you and your staff have put together.
Well, Bill, you also put out a great magazine, the UFO magazine, with a great website, and that it is really quite phenomenal.
Keep working, Bill. You never stop.
No, I never stop. It's incredible. There's so much information out there, and as I've mentioned before, I think that just in the world of UFOs, I think we are a tissue paper thin wall between what we know now and at least part of the final truth. So that's what we're chipping away at.
All right. Thanks, Bill. He's a good man, Bob.
Oh, I couldn't love him more.
And has just done a superb job on UFO Hunters.
Yeah.
If you had a chance to go back to the Mayan era, what would you look for? What would you want to really see, witness?
I'd love to meet Quetzalcoatl. I really would. I'd like to just see him in the flesh and see what he was like. I think, most people, if you ask them if you could go back in history, who would you like to meet? I think, Jesus would obviously be at the top of everybody's list.
Me too.
But, he, to see the great You know, the great Quetzalcoatl would be, you know, would be something magnificent. And by the way, I wanted to say something that, you know, we keep talking about these disasters. I want to stress to the readers, this novel is a hero's journey. I don't believe in writing depressing novels.
No, you always are upbeat.
And I think the hope, and, you know, I don't want to flatter you too much, but I think there is hope. Most of what, you know, we fear is preventable. And I think it shows like this that, you know, give the clarion call. This kind of serve as a Paul Revere. And, you know, too many shows on TV and radio want to paper everything over and ignore it.
That's true.
And I think there is great hope because of, you know, quite frankly, because of, you know, people like you.
Let's squeeze in one more if we can. Bob Paul in Merced, California, west of the Rockies. About a minute for you, Paul. Go ahead.
How you doing, gentlemen?
Great.
Hi, Paul.
Just got a quick question for you. You mentioned Quetzalcoatl and Tezcatlipoca. Now I'm just wondering if you're aware of or have heard or read anything that they are actually brothers, twin brothers, that were created by Huitzilopochtli and Ometzcatl, two of the main Mexica gods at that time. Do you know that that Tezcatlipoca was actually the god of smoke and mirrors, so he does relate to Lucifer and the fact he can be called the Great Deceiver?
Well, the god of the smoking mirror, and you may well be right. One of the problems is that our knowledge of the Mayans and their religion is constantly evolving. And you may have, however, the head deity, and boy, I can't pronounce. You can probably pronounce. You seem pretty good at this. What was the big Aztec deity? He was frequently referred to as the smoking mirror. But I have no doubt the shaman, as you know, would look into smoked obsidian and they would have these visions and revelations and that staring into it, and they were thought to be staring, you know, communicating with the Aztecs believed with their god they referred to as the smoking mirror.
Yeah, Tezcatlipoca.
Yeah,
that's it. However you pronounce it, that's his name.
Yeah.
That's his name. Bob, we're running out of time. Apocalypse 2012, is it out there in the stores yet?
Oh, yeah. It's in large quantities. And also, anybody who's curious, you check my brand new website, robertgleason2012.com.
You have hit the website era now?
Oh, yeah. I got a blog on it, and I'm gonna be blogging next week. I'm gonna have a page about frequently asked questions about publishing. And I'm going to try to get lots of really interesting people to blog about 2012 on the website.
All right. We'll put a link of that website up on our coasttocoastam.com.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Robert. Enjoy your trip in Los Angeles. I'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Up next on our 2012 spectacular, author Daniel Pinchback, 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl. That'll be next on Coast to Coast AM. Daniel Pinchback, author of 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl, and Indigenous Prophecies and Consciousness Transformation. Contributor to the New York Times Magazine, Esquire, Rolling Stone, among many other publications, and is currently the editorial director of Evolver Magazine and the Evolver Project. Here he is on Coast to Coast. Daniel, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Me too. And I'm looking forward to meeting you. I'm going to meet you at the Harmony Festival in Santa Rosa this weekend.
Yep, that's exciting. It's a beautiful festival. I've been there the last few years.
They're expecting 30 to 50,000 people. Do they get that many people there?
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, it's a huge festival. It has very well-attended panels and also big music concerts and so on.
Super. Okay, we'll have some fun. Tell me about your interest in shamanism leading you into the exploration of prophecy here.
Well, that's what I've kind of accounted in my first books. I mean, I had a personal kind of breakthrough visiting tribal groups, working with visionary plant medicines like ayahuasca and iboga and mushrooms. And that led me to take seriously what indigenous cultures say, even about the time that we're in now. And then I discovered the kind of Mayan calendar, which ends in 2012, and the Hopi prophecies and other prophecies from around the world that seem to sync up with those.
Something is afoot for so many civilizations to be prophesizing. And then, of course, the Mayans specifically, they knew something. The question is, Daniel, how? What's your take?
Well, it seems like they had they were very dedicated astronomers. And it seemed that they put a huge amount of effort understanding kind of cycles, you know, in the same way that, you know, astrology kind of works to a certain extent. I mean, you know, I'm a Gemini and have a lot of those characteristics.
Yeah, me too, same
thing.
They
seem to have understood these kind of larger cosmic cycles and their significance. And, you know, it was some combination of, you know, not ordinary states of consciousness they were exploring almost scientifically, and then astronomy, which led them to arrive at this galactic alignment in 2012 as a major shift, at the very least the end of the long count, but according to different archaeologists, you know, a shift from one world age to the next, you know, happening in this time.
I wonder if many of them all came to the same conclusions together, or if they argued about it. I wonder how this all came to be.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, people like John Major Jenkins have looked at this carefully, and you know, they clearly went through some kind of serious, you know, intellectual process to arrive at this alignment and this understanding.
The significance of this date, December 21st, 2012, winter solstice, of course, why is this an end date? Why not a beginning date?
Well, it is. I mean, in a way, it's a return to the center. It's an alignment between the Earth and the Sun and the galactic center, the dark rift at the center of the Milky Way. So in that way, it's a way of kind of charting or locating, you know, our kind of our physical position in the cosmos. So in that way, it's an opening. You know, and for me, it's very much about our consciousness and about participation. You know, it's not a passive event. Even at this point, we still have a tremendous amount of choice as to what's going to happen as we go through this transition.
Do you think that they were more astronomically inclined as opposed to spiritually, or both?
I don't think there was a duality for them. In that respect, I think that they saw, you know, it's alchemy. You know, alchemists in the Western tradition talk about as above, so below.
Yeah.
You know, so they recognized there was this integration between these cosmic cycles and spiritual truths.
Daniel, you have always looked into the possibility of end times, apocalypse prophecy, and you predict that we are in an apocalypse now.
Well, I mean, apocalypse literally means a revealing or uncovering. And the way I approached it in my book, 2012, was looking at it from the perspective of the kind of Carl Jung psychology that Jung and his followers really saw that this was this time of the apocalypse, and that there was a kind of initiatory process for the modern Western psyche that was happening at this time. So for me, yeah, it's in a way like, you know, we have to get to the truth of our situation and recognize the delusions of our culture and our media, and then, you know, somehow work our way through to creating a planetary culture that, you know, it can thrive, and that also kind of reintegrates kind of the spiritual knowledge into its core.
When I hear apocalypse, I think of this is it. This is the end. It's over for all of us. We're destroyed. Is that the way to think about this?
I definitely do not think that's the way to think about it. As I said, apocalypse literally means uncovering or revealing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there may be some destruction as we go through it, but it's really an initiatory process for the human psyche. I think that we're shifting to a different level of consciousness, a different level of responsibility and awareness. And it's really about, you know, us kind of activating ourselves and taking responsibility for the planetary situation, and then also taking responsibility for our own spiritual development and our inner development.
This shift of awareness, too, could be dramatic, don't you think?
It could be. You know, I mean, for me, it's really a question of how quick this awakening process happens. I mean, if we continue the way we're going, you know, we probably will see, you know, mass famine and you know, massive coastal flooding and depopulation, you know, in our time. However, I don't think that's necessarily in the cards. You know, if we were to begin to rationally reallocate global resources and rethink our, you know, redesign our financial systems and everything else. I mean, all the problems that are happening on the planet are basically, you know, the problems created by human consciousness, and therefore potentially a different level of consciousness could address them and solve them.
Well, that's true. In 2012, the return of Quetzalcoatl, you, of course, key in on him. Tell me your thoughts on Quetzalcoatl, and also some interesting things happened with you.
Yeah, well, I had a personal experience. I was working with a religion in Brazil, Santo Daime, that uses a plant medicine called ayahuasca as its sacrament. And during the ceremonies with the Daime, I began to have kind of a voice that spoke in my head and announced itself as Quetzalcoatl. And over the course of a week, I received a kind of prophetic transmission, which is at the end of my book. However, you know, for me, it wasn't, you know, like a personally aggrandizing scenario. It was more that Quetzalcoatl represents this next frequency of consciousness, and it was kind of using me as a vessel to get this information or this message out to people. And for me, Quetzalcoatl is you know, the feathered serpent, so it's the meeting of the bird and the snake, which is also the meeting of air and matter, spirit and matter. You know, the snake is on the ground, the bird's feathers are up in the air. So for me, it's as those it's the integration of these opposites of spirit and matter. That you know, it could also be a representation of the Western scientific knowledge system integrating with indigenous shamanism and Eastern metaphysics. And it's really as these different forms of knowing and approaching reality come together, this next level of human consciousness gets created.
Was this message difficult to translate, or was it very easy for you to understand?
Well, you know, it took some work. I mean, it was kind of... It was a ferocious experience. The voice was very powerful, and it brought up karmic baggage in my own life and what seemed to be other past lives. And in a way, it was almost somewhere between humbling and humiliating to suddenly find myself like the vessel of some other form of consciousness or something like that.
You mentioned the Hopis, Daniel, and I've been fascinated with their prophecy as well. Theirs is somewhat dramatic. Theirs... In at least what I interpret it to be, some very difficult times of their prophecy before things get better here, somewhat like Revelation. But I feel the Hopi prophecy is a little more direct and in a little more catastrophe type.
Yeah, I mean, it is true. I mean, I went for the book for 2012. I went and talked to one of the lineage holders and elders, and, you know, he talked about this time being a time of purification and seemed to expect there to be kind of you know, drastic wars and depopulation. But you know, even with that, I mean, it's a question of what prophecy is and how it's held. And for me, you know, it's not necessarily the case that any one dire scenario is going to come to pass. I mean, you know, we have an agency here, and even as things get down to the wire, you know, we still have the opportunity to, you know, break out of the script and activate our, you know, our intelligence. I mean, the Mayan creation myth, the Popol Vuh, is all about these human heroes or half-human, you know, half-god heroes who use their cunning and intelligence to outwit the negative forces and the lords of death. So for me, that's really what it's about. Like, we have this opportunity to outwit fate in a way.
Can we?
Yeah, definitely.
But there will be many who try to fight us, I think. We can see what's happening around this planet right now, Daniel. There are those who do not want, I think, most of us to advance, to grow.
Well, yeah, that's true. But then we also see in our recent past, like, incredible events like the you know, fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989,
yeah.
and how nobody had predicted that, you know, that could just happen without nuclear conflict or violent, you know, civil war, insurrection. So in a way, you know, when human consciousness has reached a certain point, you know, things can happen that seem totally impossible.
Well, we saw that. We saw the collapse of the Soviet Union, but it seems like we did not take advantage of it the right way.
That's for sure. I mean, in order for us to take advantage of a moment, you know, like that, there would have to be a really great game plan.
And there was none.
No, there wasn't. There wasn't at that point. So they the only model that they had, you know, to look at was you know, Western capitalism and neoliberalism. But I think there is a new model that's kind of emerging right now that, you know, combines ideas from people like Buckminster Fuller,
mm-hmm.
and then ideas about how to create alternative economic models. I mean, I'm very inspired right now by Bernard Lettier's work, The Future of Money, and then Tom Greco's new book, The End of Money and the Future of Civilization. And they're really looking at very you know, tangible mechanisms through which we could create a different economic system where you know, the wealth would be shared more equitably.
Sure.
And so on. local communities would be rewarded and so on.
Look into your crystal ball. Only 10 years out, what do you see?
10 years from now?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, it seems like we're going into almost like a nonlinear dynamic kind of scenario. I mean, I'm very intrigued, as I'm sure you are also, by, you know, the notion of UFOs, extraterrestrials, crop circles. And obviously, if all that stuff is happening,
mm-hmm.
you know, they're not getting across the universe burning, you know, coal in their engines, you know. So that means that there are higher levels of technology that may be more consciousness mediated. They may be more participatory, with consciousness. I see the potential for a psychic evolution of the human species, and that, you know, when I visited the Hopi and learned about, you know, how effective their rain dances are and so on, and correlated that with a lot of other information, you know, it may be that, as humans, we're capable of tremendous, psychic feats, you know, once we know what we're doing and we, you know, have the right intention and work together, you know, so if we shift it into a more psychic frame, an evolution might happen that would exceed anything that we can even really imagine from this point.
Did you enjoy your visits with the Hopi?
I loved them. I mean, I had beautiful experiences there. I drove down with somebody who got kind of freaked out and then left me there. But it turned out to be really a lucky thing because then I had to hitchhike. And every time I hitchhiked, I would meet like an incredibly cool new person. You know, and I went to one of their rain dances, the Kachina dances. And after the dance, everybody opened their houses. You could go and eat, you know, a meal with anybody in the whole village. I mean, unimaginable in a modern Western city.
I bet they don't lock doors either, do they?
I don't think so.
No, things are different.
Have you visited them?
No, I have not. I'd love to. When's your next trip to do that? Do you do it often?
I've only visited them once, and the next trip will be when I'm, you know, when Spirit calls me to go down there.
Did they talk much about their prophecy?
Well, they did. I mean, I went to visit. I'm not sure I remember his name off the top of my head, but I went to visit one of the elders, and visited on his field where he was hoeing his corn and bean. I mean, that's, you know, they've maintained these extraordinary subsistence farming methods.
Very simple
and
life.
And actually, as part of their prophecy understanding, at the end of the world age, you know, the elder white brother is going to go to them to learn from them, you know, these types of methods of subsistence farming and also their ritual practices, but with an open heart and an open, you know, mind. So he was wonderful. I mean, he, was very open about the prophecies and it was good to get that transmission, of their culture.
Did they ever talk about the ant people?
I've heard a little bit. Well, what do you think about the ant people?
Well, obviously they think that there is a subterranean civilization going on this planet, and that fascinates me just all by itself. Whether it's extraterrestrial or humankind, the fact that human beings or creatures would be living underground.
Yeah, well, it may be more infra-dimensional or interdimensional.
Well, that's true too.
And it does seem like that correlates with a lot of you know, kind of weird ideas that maybe have, you know, a kind of validity to them, but only if you take like these kind of other proximate dimensions, you know, into account.
Tell me what you've been working on lately, Dan.
Well, I launched a social network, Evolver.net, and also we have a web magazine, RealitySandwich.com. We published an anthology of works from Reality Sandwich toward 2012, Perspectives on the Next Age. And basically with Evolver, we're trying to create a scaffolding for local offline communities to, come together around issues that they believe in and hopefully, you know, begin to try out some methods of social change and community organization, you know, kind of in it before, you know, the stuff, the brown stuff, it's the big fan, you know.
many have been thinking about doing things in community now. I never thought I'd see this, but it seems to be pretty widespread.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think humans have a natural, you know, political and tribal kind of, you know, nature. And that's been kind of suppressed, you know, in the modern culture, you know, by the consumerism and the media and so on. So I think, you know, now people really, you know, for their own well-being are going to have to kind of reaccess that basic part of their nature. And when they do, they'll actually find that they're a lot happier because I think doing things, you know, with other people that we love and respect, like that is happiness, you know, not just like working for some company that we don't really care about, you know.
When December 21st, 2012 comes about, what's going to happen?
What's going to happen? You know, I really try not to be fundamentalist about the date. And on the other hand, I continue to have a lot of synchronicities around it. Like last summer, I was in England, and I was in the crop circle area. The last day that I was there, I visited the last crop circle I was going to see that year, and it turned out to be the solar system as it would be configured on December 21st, 2012.
That's amazing.
I tend to think that we're on the cusp of the shift from the physical and biological phase of our species evolution to a psychic phase of evolution. So I don't pretend to know exactly what's going to happen on that date. It might be a hinge point in this process. Maybe we'll have opened the gateway to other types of cosmic intelligences, galactic civilizations, extraterrestrials, or maybe it'll be everything coming down to few resources left and people blowing each other's brains out,
Maybe
we'll get some of both. I mean, I don't know. I have a very positive feeling about it, that we've sort of pushed ourselves into a situation where psychic energy and miracles are going to be necessary. And, I believe that we can produce those.
Do you feel this push, though, with Big Brother? I mean, it's coming, Daniel. I think it's rolling along. I don't know the outcome. I trust we will win. But I can feel it, can't you?
Yeah, I mean, I personally believe that Obama is a part of a kind of, deep New World Order conspiracy.
Some people believe that. Lots of people believe that.
Yeah, I think if you look at, what the gap between, his statements and what the policy has been, which has basically been to, hand over, fork over, huge amounts of money to the financial elite, who are really the ones responsible for the financial meltdown. It's quite possible that there's a engineered level to this whole crisis, and it's an attempt to move towards some kind of one world order scenario. I don't think that I think that that human consciousness is going to rise up in rebellion against this outcome.
Interesting. Daniel Pinchbeck, our guest. We'll take phone calls with Daniel now. On Coast to Coast AM. Okay, next up, we'll take your phone calls with our special guest this hour, Daniel Pinchbeck. Next hour, Dr. Christian von Laer joins us with his views on 2012. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you, Daniel Pinchbeck, and your phone calls as well. Let's go to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And no, let's go east first. Brad in New York, you've been holding. Hi, Brad.
Hi, George. How you doing?
Good.
Another great show, and so much to learn, Daniel.
My gosh.
George will always tell you this, too, and I know this. Don't ever eat a killer Lebanese salad at night and go to your dentist the next day. You will not win friends. But my question here is the normal transition of the ancestors in North America basically came over from the Bering Straits. But when you look at the statues of the Mayans, there has been some people who thought they came from Polynesia, and I was wondering if they ever did any DNA on the Mayan people to basically find out where they did come from.
Oh, I don't know that. That's a good question, but I don't know the answer to that.
Okay, because I read something one time that they thought maybe they did come across the oceans in the southern part of the Pacific.
That sounds familiar to me too, but I don't have the citation in my head enough to verify it.
Well, at any rate, always a great show. Thank you so much.
Okay, sure thing, Brad. Where did they go, in your opinion, Dan? They just seem to just dissipate.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously there's Jared Diamond's work, and there's the belief that they overshot their scenario ecologically. But then there's also Jose Arguelles' notion, that maybe they sort of were done with their mission. In a way, they created the civilization. I mean, it's our vision that if you have a civilization, you want it to go forever, like America forever. It may be that they saw it differently, and that they knew, because they were so attuned to cycles and temporality, cycles of time and cosmic cycles, that they were only going to, be doing this for a few, hundred years in order to codify this knowledge system and this understanding about cycles and so on. And then once that work was done, they kind of retreated back into the tribal world, or, according to Arguelles, maybe even the top level, high priests, kings, and wizards, were able to, disincarnate and travel back to, other worlds.
Next up, let's go to Mark in Oregon, wild card line. Hi, Mark. You're up with us.
Good evening, George and Daniel. Great to speak with you.
Sure thing.
You know, Daniel, you were mentioning the psychic awakening of mankind in 2012. And I wanted to ask you, being as shortly after that, you also mentioned that you do believe that Barack Obama, although he's only a puppet, the more important issue, of course, is that he's being used by a New World Order conspiracy of some powerful people here. And I see the actual agenda of these people as far as the eugenics aspect of their plan, which is a very major part of it, and it's mostly directed right, at us, and we're seeing the brunt of it now, and it will only increase from here on out in a very short time frame of months. It looks like they're moving faster all the time to bring it all into reality leading up to the percentile, which they quote, Daniel, if you read their papers carefully at the highest levels, is a 99% plus elimination of the world's population in very short order, within the matter of a few years. And this recent flu pandemic, so to speak, or so-called, that we had, has been seen by such worthies and well-informed people and researchers as Alex Jones.
You have a question? I'm sorry.
Yes. How do you see the eugenics aspect is coming into it, Daniel?
It hasn't been a principal concern of mine. I mean, I don't think even that there's a conspiracy of powerful men. I think it's more of there's more of an occult or esoteric dimension to it, which is very much like if you get into shamanism, and shamans versus sorcerers, there are kind of interdimensional agencies. Like the Gnostics talked about the archons, who are kind of these off-planet entities who are kind of mischief makers, So I think there's that level that things are really happening on, and I also think that we have to be careful about the paranoia. Maybe that sounds crazy after what I just stated, but I think I like the concept of pronoia just as much as paranoia, that we can, either look at everything conspiring against us and this New World Order conspiracy is going to, bring it down, or the pronoic perspective is that, everything is conspiring to give us like the most amazing, fascinating adventure of a life that we could possibly imagine. And to me that rings more true, maybe just because I have a more positive outlook. I think we're in a great movie right now, and I don't think we're going to live to see some 99% depopulation. I think that God is a better film director than that.
Daniel, why does it seem that this push for this New World Order seems to be revving up and working at a clip that defies the imagination?
I don't know. I mean, you had Richard Hoagland on earlier, yes?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, he has this interesting perspective that, there may have been knowledge about this change in cycles, which is kind of like a frequency shift in the Earth. And actually, it makes it much harder for, people and entities that are holding this older frequency of kind of greed and ego and materialism, the Earth is actually becoming more uncomfortable for them. And 2012 may be some kind of like deadline where they really can't function here anymore. So it may be that there's some effort to kind of orchestrate, a hyperspace technology or some kind of technological effort to get them out of here before we reach this kind of Aquarian state where there's going to be, I think, like a massive heart opening on a global scale, and then the shift into a more collaborative and cooperative state of consciousness. So they may have been aware for a very long time that they only have a window of opportunity before that new energy shifts the world's frequency.
Good point. They're on a deadline.
Exactly.
Next up, let's go to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. First-time caller. Hey, Sean, go ahead.
Hey, how you guys doing?
We're great.
Tonight.
Thanks.
Let me start off saying, go Pittsburgh Penguins if you guys are following
the Red Wings all the way.
Oh, no.
Home ice advantage, Sean.
I know. It's a great series. But anyways.
Yes, both teams are playing well, but go ahead.
Do you think us knowing the possibility of even something happening in 2012. I'm not really familiar with the subject, but I mean, I know a decent amount. Do you think it's altering what's going to happen or fuels it? I mean, like, what if we had no idea?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it alters it. Again, I think we're learning one of the lessons of our time is that reality is less subjective and less fixed than we thought it was, and it's more participatory and co-creative. So as we become more aware of the kind of potentials and potencies of the present and almost like the different, you know, kind of paths that we can sort of construct subjectively that lead into that future, you know, our intention may and our awareness may shift what's allowed to manifest in our reality.
Absolutely. Michael Cremo believes civilizations go back hundreds and hundreds of millions of years, Daniel, which he then says we had high technology, incredible knowledge. Do you subscribe to that?
I kind of do, actually. I don't know about hundreds of millions of years. That seems like a long time. But I think that we're part of a much larger, you know, kind of Shakespearean cosmic drama. And in a way, we've been in some kind of quarantine, you know, so that we can go through this transition process. And then, you know, maybe, you know, once we reach this next threshold, we get, you know, we get more of the story. But yeah, I mean, I'm very interested in the idea that there was some kind of, you know, pre-historical civilization, kind of an Atlantean civilization, and that they might have had high technologies, you know, that were kind of anti-gravity technologies. I mean, this is spoken of in a lot of ancient scriptures and so on, like, you know, Vedic scriptures and so on. You know, we might have been in more contact, direct contact with extraterrestrial, you know, open communication with extraterrestrial civilizations at that point. I think that's probably part of the story that we're going to learn as we go forward.
Okay, next up, Biloxi, Mississippi, east of the Rockies. Jeff, go ahead.
Yes, Daniel Pinchbeck, I read your book, Return of Quetzalcoatl and Breaking Open the Head. And
cool.
I wanted to ask you a question.
Sure.
About the hallucinogenic drug, is it pronounced ayahuasca?
Ayahuasca, yeah.
I read about a lot of different people's experiences with that, like Rick Straussman's book, The Spirit Molecule.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yep.
Do you recommend that for everybody? I know it's not your position to endorse drugs, but do you think that is something where you can open up windows to alternate universes or whatever they are, parallel universes? Or what is your comment on that?
As you said, I don't recommend it. I mean, I don't advocate it. You know, for me personally, those experiences were very valuable. You know, while most experiences of that substance are still illegal in the U.S., although not necessarily all of them at this point, because the Supreme Court recently decided in the favor of Unio de Vegetalis, which is a Brazilian religion that uses ayahuasca as its sacrament. Most uses of it would still be at least in a gray area of legality, if not out and out illegal. However, you can go to South America, you know, where the substance is legal, and take it in ceremonial contexts with shamans of various types. So you know, for those who have a questing spirit and you know, yearn to you know, voyage into other dimensions and meet the ancestors and the spirits, you know, I could see the value of a trip to South America to explore it for yourself.
Some say it tastes like pumpkin juice, Daniel, does it?
God, pumpkin juice never occurred to me. It's definitely an unbelievable taste, a very memorable taste that if I think about it long enough, I can start to shiver and shake.
Sure. Not that we all drink pumpkin juice, right? Let's go to Rock Springs, Wyoming, west of the Rockies. Pat, your question.
Yeah, good evening, gentlemen. Great show. Love
hey.
It. I was in Lamanai, Belize, not too long ago, and our guide on the river there, he was telling us that from as far as he can remember, his great-great-grandparents had always believed. I mean, it's like, I guess he was part Malayan or Aztec there. Either one, I can't recall. Anyhow,
and speak up for me, Pat.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did we teach them the calendar? I mean,
did we teach them the calendar?
You mean the log count calendar? Well, it is interesting. I mean, the indigenous Maya of today, you know, although they maintain the sacred day count, this 260 day Zulkin count with the day signs, they had lost the long count, which is the 5,125 year cycle that ends in December 2012. So in that respect, it was really our Western archaeologists who kind of rediscovered this material and have now brought it back to the indigenous people. So there's a very interesting kind of acculturation process going on. We're now, you know, some of the Mayan indigenous shamans kind of reject it, but others have embraced it and yes, are saying. I mean, I recently interviewed, I'm also working on a film project, 2012, timeforchange.com, but we've interviewed some indigenous Maya intellectuals and so on, and you know, they're saying that yes, this you know, they now see 2012 as a crucial window where we, you know, we have this opportunity to become, you know, more intelligent and discerning and activate our critical faculties to get through this transition. You know, and if we don't do that, then the gods may decide that, you know, that they can wipe us out.
Sandwich, Illinois. Hello, Carl. Welcome to the show, it's Kyle.
My name is Kyle, actually. I'm sorry about that, George.
That's right.
I got a couple questions. First, great show last night with Richard. I wanted to talk to him really bad. My first question is to the gentleman that here is on tonight. That's been bugging me. What year is it really? Because when you look at the calendar base, we're based off of Jesus Christ. And I that just kind of like confuses me due to the fact that I don't know what year it is, because and when you look at history, you see it Socrates is before Christ, mm-hmm. and Plato and everything else like that. I mean, that's my really question that I've been looking for is, what is that answer? What is the year really right now? And how does that affect the 2012
era? Well, I mean,
era?
You know, what is a year? I mean, any timekeeping system we use is an artifice, right? In a sense, it's year zero. I mean, it's the same year it's always been, you know? I mean, you know, one way of keeping the time is the Gregorian calendar. The Mayans had a different way. You know, when you synchronize their method of timekeeping with ours, then you get, you know, 2012 as the end of their long count. You know, I think it's like 13.0.0.0.0 or something like that. But you know, I think like one of the neat things about even thinking about the whole Mayan approach to time is that it's so different than ours, and it really shows you how conceptual time is. Like even our whole model of a linear progressive historical time is a recent artifact in human thought. You know, and it may be that we'll come to conceive of time and actually to perceive time and realize our lives in time differently in the future.
Good point. Next up, let's go to North Dakota. Welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Well, thanks, George. I'm really enjoying the program, and I've been listening for, it seems like, two decades. But well,
thanks for supporting us.
I'm just very grateful for your program, first off. But I'd like to say, you know, in North Dakota and Bismarck yesterday, they tied a record that was kept from 1877 of a low of 35 degrees. But what I'm wondering, you know, strings, circles, waves, all this is connected. And you mentioned something about 26,000 years, 25,000 years coming around again. And I know what my question is the polar shift or magnetic shift. And then I'll also one other thing about the Rig Vega, if that's related at all. And that's my question.
I don't know what the relationship to the Rig Veda would be. I mean, unless you have something specific. I mean, like 25,800 years is the great year. It's the precession of the equinoxes, and on that kind of matrix where we're now shifting, you know, between the age of Pisces and the age of Aquarius. So, yeah, I mean that's one way to look at the situation.
Daniel, tell me about your connection with alien abduction accounts and what you call traditional fairy stories.
That's a cool question. Yeah, well, I mean, I have some sections in my book, 2012, about alien abductions, and you know, I had some as I became fascinated by the subject, which was kind of inspired by my work with the crop circles. I began to have kind of dream experiences, around kind of similar phenomenon, And if you look at there's a lot of corollaries between the alien abduction accounts and traditional fairy stories. These kind of beings from the other world who, often provide food that you shouldn't eat, that take you away to these different places. It seems as if it's almost as if this archetype of this other world is the essential thing, and then it's given different kind of iterations depending where we are in terms of our social development and our technological development.
Next up, let's go to Billings, Montana. Rocco, west of the Rockies. Go ahead, Rocco.
George and Daniel, thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I have a question. I've asked it before, and I can't seem to get an answer for it. There's a book called The Money Matrix of the New World Order, and the author there uses some pretty convincing evidence that the economic collapse is tied to December 21st, 2012. You know anything about that, Daniel?
No, but I mean, I guess there's another economic kind of consultant, Germano Salante, maybe, who talks about 2012 being when, things are going to totally melt down in the U.S. Economic-wise.
Hmm.
And, for me, it's like there's definitely a lot of dire predictions. So, rather than, stewing in all of this, the question is, what are we going to do, now in the time that's available to us? And I think that, alternative economic systems, can be made use of, including something as simple as, the time dollar, where people, there's software available where you can create local systems where people start exchanging hours. Just anything that starts to get it deprogram and depattern us, from the money system, I think is going to be helpful to begin to shift people's perception, because we sort of gotten locked in this thinking that, this particular form of money is the only way that we can exchange value, and it's actually a very arbitrary thing that's been kind of forced upon us.
And things will be changing soon enough. Daniel, get out your website for us, would you please?
Sure. The social network is evolver.net, and there we started a series of offline meetups. The first is going to be June 17th, which we're calling Evolver Spores, and there's 14 cities that are having those, and people can look on the website for details. The second one is realitysandwich.com, and that's our web magazine. And the third is 2012timeforchange.com, which is a sort of teaser for this documentary that I'm working on.
Super. I'll see you this weekend at the Harmony Festival, Daniel. Up next, Dr. Christian von Lehr, his theory on 2012. And this hour, Dr. Christian von Lehr joins us. We talk about another incredible theory of 2012. Dr. Christian von Lehr is a well-known clairvoyant psychic medium who has been sharing his proficiency with spiritual realms for more than 40 years. Christian also lectures routinely around the country on higher planes of consciousness, archangels, angels and nature people, and demonstrates them live to audiences. Speaking on most metaphysical subjects, he has written a book which combines his many decades of the spiritual research with a currently popular topic, of course, 2012 in the Mayan calendar. Here's Dr. Christian von Lehr. Hello, Christian. How are you?
Hello. Good morning. How are you?
Good to have you on the program.
No, thank you. Happy for having me.
You're anchoring the last hour for us here.
Oh, that's the best hour, right?
Yeah, tell me a little bit about yourself. I haven't had a chance to talk with you.
Well, as your introduction mentioned, I am a clairvoyant, claircognizant psychic medium, which is not just psychism, but the ability to see life on the other side, and including angels and extraterrestrials and our own spiritual bodies. And as a medium, we can connect to those things. A claircognizant allows us to have an extra ability to sort of know what's going to go on without actually seeing it or picking it up psychically. And so I've been doing that for many, many decades, but parallel with that, I've also been studying religions and philosophies of the ancient world and the ancient wisdom, and nowadays I sort of put the two together.
What's the significance of 1111 with this Mayan calendar end date?
The significance is that the Mayans were seeking divinity, and the alignment and the positioning of the sun over the center of the galaxy indicates the halfway mark in man's evolution. And that halfway mark is the signifier that all civilizations have been looking for to indicate that mankind has finally made it. The evolution of man, the consciousness of man, evolves in sort of a circular pattern. We start sort of spiritual, and we go through this denser course of life And we're just ending that phase now, or I should say in the 2012 event. It will mark the point in which we've finished that uphill road, and now we will start our journey on the more spiritual side of life.
I've asked all the other guests, how did the Mayans know? Nobody really knows, but I'll ask you that too.
Well, the Mayans knew because they were associated with other civilizations. I would tell you that the Mayans are actually connected with the Hindu, another type of Indian, of course, which had a predecessor, which would be Atlanteans. There are many. I need to start by talking about other civilizations, probably.
Okay.
We need to mention Atlanteans and Lemurians, Balerians, other types of life, because the consciousness of man didn't just start out as physical right now. It took a lot of effort to get us to this stage, and so we go through these races of man, we call them. And so this one we're in right now is called the Indo-class, and the association with the Mayans is actually with the Hindus in the sense that they crossed the land bridges and came over to do some of their observations of an alignment, because it was signifying this particular event. So most people don't realize that there is connection to other civilizations across the world, but that's where the land bridges come in, and actually they've moved across more than once. This has something to do with the receding ice ages, and the continent of Atlantis, for example, would be up there under the Arctic, and can move freely around the world in five different regions or five different civilizations. One of those was Hindu and Mesopotamia. But they also went to the Mayan areas, and the Hindus actually went back and forth.
Okay, now, in terms of this date, this very special date, we all think that it could be a moment of higher consciousness. It could be some earth-wide calamity. It could be a celestial event. If the sun could shoot an X-flare our way, who knows what. What do you think?
Well, all of those would occur. So let's sort of take them in sequence. Because of the alignment itself and the celestial movement of bodies, there will be physical effects. So we'll have issues with the sun and other planets and perhaps other things in the solar system too. And we'll feel those effects on the Earth. And in fact, the Earth itself will have shifts and movements. But more importantly, this is the crux of this, is that center of the Milky Way. It represents this tree or cross in religions and spirituality, and it sort of separates heaven and hell. So the Mayans were looking for that because it would be an indication that we would finally cross over and we would reach that heavenly state. We would become divine beings. But it was very significant because mankind, as we are now, as apart from Atlanteans, Lemurians, other types of life, we are the first ones to finally have made it. So this is a big deal. We will be the first consciousness to finally achieve this state. And so this cross, the tree, which represents the Garden of Eden, the Yggdrasil tree, and many other religions, signifies this particular point. And, of course, it's a spiritual purpose. And the planets that come into play, Venus, Mercury, Mars, all of those are part of this dance that signify and herald this big change that's coming on. What's significant, though, is because of the change of consciousness, man is no longer going to be the dense physical being that he is, and so it marks what we call the end of souls or the end of man in this sense. The physical constitution that man is now will change. We will become a energetically lighter type of being, in which case we're becoming more of a spiritual being. So man really refers to this physical being, and we'll become more of a spiritual type being. But as a consequence of that, everyone will make this, and this is where the end of days and end of souls come in. If everyone doesn't shift their consciousness along with this cycle, and they will be helped, by the way, then they would become what we call the lost soul. So we know that everyone won't make it, but there's a pretty good guarantee that most of us can. This is going to be a sort of a cling or sing type situation. If you cling to the material ways and the nature of the past, we probably wouldn't make it. But here's the thing. The alignment is causing certain things to happen, especially that center of the galaxy. And I don't believe most people who speak of 212 talk about that center too much, but we feel influences from the center of the galaxy. In fact, there's another star there, which we would consider the second star of Bethlehem. But the influence from that center of the galaxy is being blocked for a short period of time during the eclipse, and a ratcheting effect is going on where influences that we were getting before are blocked for a period of about 10 hours, and then the sun is unblocked again, and we get locked into this new phase we're talking about. But this new phase is actually a midpoint. The ancients, and in the ancient wisdom, the key portion of time was the midpoint, not the actual phase. So it's marking the second half of the phase of life that we're in right now. So we're going to be entering this new phase. But when we complete man as we are now, we will actually become a less dense person, a more spiritual person. And those of us that are becoming more enlightened are the ones that will be saved. Now, because of this change in event, the effects of the center of the galaxy and the other planetary alignments, the energies that influence us change as well. Because those are changing, it actually helps us. So innately, we will have a better, be in a better position to raise our consciousness, so to speak. And it's sort of an unfolding, but we will be in a better position to realize that better nature of us. And so only those that refuse that higher nature, the ones I say are clinging, are the ones that would be lost.
Now, when you say some will be helped, those who, you know, can't figure out how to do this, who's going to help them?
The ones that make it are the ones that are, that by their own constitution and nature, have already earned this. Most mankind has technically already earned the right to go further. It took a lot to get us to this point of development, evolution of consciousness. So most of us potentially can do it right now. We are the only ones that our free will are the only thing that would stand in our way. So if we continue to be just material, refuse the more spiritual nature of us, which will start emerging. It doesn't have to change immediately because our constitution itself will change. We will technically become more psychic, for example, more intuitive. We will notice this change. As long as we go with that flow, we should make it because we've actually handled the hard part already. So to help us along, though, we do have watchers, for example, angels and archangels, and there is extraterrestrial life involved also because there is life everywhere. In this story that we're speaking to about Earth life, it, of course, pertains to other places in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But there are archangels involved, and archangels are associated with those planets that are participating in the alignment and the other events that are going on in 2012. So behind all of those planets is an archangel, and they are supposedly ushering us forward. This also is where Quetzalcoatl comes in, which is the archangel Samuel, the snake or serpent that was tempting Eve in the Garden of Eden. And, of course, the tree in the Garden of Eden also represents that center of the galaxy. The other archangels would be Archangel Haniel, which is associated with the planet Venus. Archangel Raphael associated with the planet Mercury. All of these will be part of the situation during that event. So they are helping us, and they've been helping us all along to get us to this point, even though Samuel, or the serpent, which is sort of a good guy, bad guy, has been tempting us all along, as in the story of the Garden of Eden. But that's where the story of the fallen angels came in. The purpose was to help man progress quickly, and that's where Samuel came in. He was the key archangel that wanted to test mankind more stringently than might occur other places in the universe so that we could progress faster. And so in this sense, he now becomes the good guy. But Venus, Archangel Haniel, is sort of watching over him. It's always watched over that center part of the galaxy, that cross of the galaxy, also sometimes referred to as the rose.
Christian, tell me about the possibility of catastrophe during this period.
Well, catastrophe is going to be guaranteed mainly because of alignments. But catastrophe to what degree? Because of the alignments, the shifts in the planet, the magnetism, the effects of the other planets, catastrophes on Earth will occur, but they always do occur anyway. Catastrophes, however, usually occur whenever there's one of these great epic changes. Most people think there would be one related to water because the last one was water, but actually the ancients indicated that these alternated. They went from fire to water to fire to water. So since the last one was by water, there will be catastrophe, of course, of some sort by fire. But that is sort of a symbol that we're making this change. The Mayans didn't actually consider that an evil portent, so to speak. It was a natural signifier that we've actually reached this point of crossing. Now, the Earth must change because the energies in the matrices and vortexes of the Earth itself influence us. So they have to change and shift too in order to better support this new constitution of energy that we will be made of.
Fascinating. The work that you put into this, where did you go for your research? How did this come to you?
Well, the civilizations of life that the ancient wisdom speaks to goes back about 40,000 years, even though recorded history in written form is much less. But it does exist in pottery and architecture and carvings, and it's been very consistent. The ancients were very good at keeping the information consistent. And along the way, there are books, such as the books of the stanzas of Daizan, I Ching, a lot of Tibetan books, Theosophy, the Rig Veda. A lot of ancient texts have this information, and it's kind of difficult to understand, of course, because the ancients tried to protect this information, so they did it metaphorically. So it takes some effort, but you can study it and learn the keys, that we call these keys to understanding these symbols. For example, C would represent souls near the side, but also the Milky Way. So the C that even the Egyptians were looking for was that Milky Way, the center of the Milky Way.
Interesting. It's pretty fascinating work. And the clock ticks, doesn't it, Christian?
Oh, the clock ticks, yeah. But that's the movement of the galaxy. That central spiraling is like a mechanism, and that's why the Mayans were looking at it, because as that spiral turns around and the equinoxes get us back into position, when we block that center of the galaxy, we're blocking a central set of influences that have always been affecting us during this phase of existence. So as we've cycled into this new phase and we block the center of the galaxy with the sun and the eclipse, suddenly the influence stops from the Milky Way. And in the center of the Milky Way, it isn't just a black hole. There's also a star there that spiritually we've been looking for. And then it will start again, and that causes that clicking effect. And so it's like a big gear. And so when this gear switches during this alignment, after the sun moves away and the eclipse is no longer blocked, it now gets locked in, and we are now starting that next cycle.
Do you think there's going to be a second coming?
Well, there will be a second coming. There's always a Messiah, a prophet comes along with these changes in epics. And even the ancient religions, as well as the ancient philosophies, spoke of a coming of a Metatron and a great spiritual leader. And that's also why we speak to this other star, the second star of Bethlehem, which should be located around the center of the galaxy as well. Again, this Metatron was supposed to be a portent of a new spiritual leader. Religion started because for their circumstance, where they were in the world at their time, a certain type of teaching was required, and so these specific teachings were religions. But yet there was a greater philosophy called an ancient wisdom. And so the ancient wisdom is unveiled through these epics. And so as we enter this new epic, there will have to be a new world teacher, so to speak, and new spiritual leaders, and there will be one of significance. And the alignments of Venus, Mercury, and Mars, or their part, I should say, in this event, is also foretold. As they herald the reception of this new leader.
And you believe this Atlantean connection is critical to all of this?
The Atlantean connection is significant because mankind wouldn't be where it is right now if there wasn't an Atlantean connection. And if you believe in Atlanteans, you'd have to also accept Lemurian and Balearian and Hyperbalearian, and all the ancient wisdom spoke of these different classes of life. We call them races of life. So all of the life in the world right now that's human-like is an Indo-race. But we didn't just start this way, which is sort of a dense. You hear it in the New Age, we talk about density of energy. That's us right now. But we were lighter in the past. That's where the Atlantean phase came in. And we learned different lessons during that Atlantean stage. For example, that's where we developed emotions. We weren't as dense as we are right now, because where we're at right now is we're developing ego. So ego this time, last time it was emotions. Prior to that was Lemurian cycle of life, and that was when we learned our animalistic instincts. And these are called races, and we go through many races. And the races in these rounds of life also are what are depicted in the Mayan and the Aztec calendars, although they each depicted something different. When we go through evolution where we're learning the consciousness of mineral, we also would follow that with a consciousness of plants and then animal, then human. Okay, those are called rounds. But within those, there are also seven races. And so the Aztec were depicting races in their calendar. And so we're on this fifth race, which is the Indo race right now. So the Atlanteans played a very important part to develop instincts. We also learned emotions. We also learned animal instincts. Now we're learning ego. But the next phase that we're entering, which is why we're calling it divinity, is because it's the phase where we bring it all together. It's the unity. And suddenly all those individual lessons that we learn through these different races of life come together and start making sense. And it's going to cause us as people to seek unity also. We will be seeking, we will become earthlings as opposed to individual members of a society or a country.
Is there an ET connection with all this as well?
Well, of course, extraterrestrial life is everywhere, and we actually see that when we do mediumship, because when we connect with people, we see alien guides, for example, behind them. But of course, the aliens, or those who we'd be reaching out to, or who could be interested in this whole process, have gone through this phase, so they want to see us get through it as well. So they act as a guide. As a matter of fact, they are part of sort of a brotherhood that helps guide all of the development of mankind. So they are a part of it in the sense that they're trying to help us along, and they've planted things, for example, such as relics in places in the earth, which creates vortices of energy, which draw us to certain places so that we all learn particular lessons. They also visit us to see how we're doing and to help us along, in which case they're probably affecting more of our DNA or things that would have a lasting effect as opposed to other operations and things people talk about. But sure, they're helping us.
Christian, we're going to take phone calls with you when we come right back. Your website, mistoftheoracle.com. And welcome back to Coast. We're with Dr. Christian Von Lehr. We're going to take your phone calls as well. So you're not too concerned about disaster in 2012 to the point where 90% of this planet will be wiped out, Christian?
No, that would not happen. We're sort of guaranteed to succeed. There would be a pretty big waste of time, I think, to have this Earth evolve to the state it has and the people on it to evolve to the state they have, to have it go away. And all these things are sort of governed by some sort of divine providence, if we're going to believe anything spiritual at all. We expect the catastrophes of varying degrees. They've always occurred, and they've always been an indication of changing conditions on the Earth to support the new type of life. So it would never be to the point where we would actually lose life. And actually, the catastrophes that are the most significant would be at the next phase after we've completed this stage that we're going through. Remember, the ancients always marked the halfway point. So we're getting a sort of a heads up that we're going to become a spiritual person in this sort of next round of life. For a while, we're going to continue to be dense as we are, but we have to get through this stage, too. And so these things we're calling catastrophes are really the Earth changing due to its influences and the planetary system's influences to make that change conducive.
Okay, to the phones we go. Fort Lauderdale, Florida, first-time caller. It's George. Hey, George. You with us?
Yes, sir.
Yep.
Is it
George or Geo?
Geo.
Oh, okay.
Thank you for taking my call. Well, just got off work and turned on the radio and heard you all mention, the guest mentioned a couple points about how this time it will be with fire instead of water and the alignment of the planets and all that stuff. I just had a question. Would it not be that when our planet, we line up with the center of the galaxy, which emits bursts of gamma rays, not cause the sun to flare, which would cause the solar flares to hit the Earth, and the gamma rays cause massive earthquakes, which would cause tsunamis, and it just seems like all that stuff he was kind of touching on a little bit, and I've just always had that in the back of my head that those things would probably happen, considering, you know, the center of the galaxy, the gamma rays.
Well, I don't know, Joe, that we would have an issue with gamma rays at this stage, because of the condition of the black hole in the center of the galaxy. Of course, the rocking effect, when you block the effects of the center of the black hole that rocking effect of that tugging on the Earth and the other planets, and then the release of it when the eclipse moves, that will have an effect on a lot of things, including our sun, in which case, subsequent to that time, we'll have effects from heat and fire, which is what I was referring to. Now, because of shifts that will occur on the Earth, there will be water issues, but the significant damage that would occur would be fire. So it could be issues with the sun or volcanoes erupting, things of that nature.
And the gamma rays wouldn't affect any?
I don't think gamma rays would come into the picture at this particular point because we're not exactly losing the black hole.
Oh. Well, thank you very much. Sure. Thank you so much.
Okay, Gio, indeed.
I could add a point, though, if I was listening to Gio's question, is a part and parcel to this whole process is the universe itself is considered to go away at one time, but it also will come back. It's also part of the great cycle. So we're just speaking and focusing on humankind's consciousness, but the way spirituality speaks is all things out in the universe have consciousness, including the planets and those things behind the universe. So even the universe would have to change at some point in time, in which case it would go away and come back. So we have an issue of scale as well.
Daniel, is this a healthy change that's going to come?
Daniel, you mean Christian?
Christian.
Yes, absolutely. As I mentioned, this is the sign that we have finally made it. Of all the consciousness that existed on this Earth, and of course there's been animal, plants, there's also been different races of consciousness, we are the first ones that have ever made it to that heavenly point where we're actually going to become spiritual people. But that's also referring to just this planet in this solar system. Extraterrestrials, for example, would have probably gone through this phase already, which is why there'll be an interest in them. But because this heralds are becoming more spiritual persons and we're going to be thinking more unified and thinking more like earthlings and our consciousness will be raised, we have the ability to actually spiritually connect with alien life better. So we will actually become citizens of the universe now as well as becoming more spiritual persons. So we win all the way around with this this alignment.
All right, let's go to Chicago now. Don, there you are. You're on Coast to Coast.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi, Don.
Good morning. I have a more basic question. I'm curious to know, did the Mayans believe that the Earth was the center of our solar system, the universe, or did they know that things revolved around the sun?
They knew that things revolved around the sun, but also they knew that we revolved around the Milky Way. What the Mayans were tracking, I don't believe people speak to this, but it isn't that they were tracking necessarily planets. Or the alignments per se, they were tracking that center of the Milky Way because that represented, the elliptic cross of that represents that tree, which Christianity and other religions and civilizations around the world acknowledge. They're tracking that and this other star that's there along with the Milky Way. So they had to be aware of that. And so they knew that every 26,000 years or so, we came into somewhat of an alignment with that and that it marked the changing of the epochs. So in other words, the Mayans knew that the center of the galaxy was the only true clock that we could rely on. Everything else was somewhat relative. And so through a process of inference, they had to track other things, but just to sort of do the plus and minus adjustments. But technically, they were tracking the center of the galaxy.
Very interesting. Thank you very much, Dr.
Certainly.
George.
Okay, you got it. Susan in Hilo, Hawaii on the wild card line. Hi, Susan.
Hey.
Aloha.
I had several things to ask, but I didn't really know how to put it, okay? So I'll make mine real simple, okay? You know about all the global warming?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, does this, oh, of course you do, but I mean, your guests think that this may have something to do with the stars' alignment, and this is what 2012 is going to do, and it's not really, because what I understand, the global warming effect happens in one way or another every around 100 years or so.
Global warming is a routine process that occurs, and it usually gets, if it gets out of hand, it gets adjusted by changes in the Earth, for example, an ice age. People are very worried about what we're doing to the atmosphere and environment, although that's responsible and a nice thing. The Earth's a pretty big place, and it's been around a long time, and it sort of knows how to take care of itself, and it was designed to succeed. My view is it would be very difficult for man to actually destroy this Earth in any particular way. So if there's something that ails the planet, so to speak, it will find a way and a time to take care of that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Susan?
Okay, so we're not going to blow ourselves up.
No, we're not going to blow ourselves up. We may try. But again, as I mentioned before in the presentation, mankind has actually come into the point where they can rationalize things and will never let things quite get out of hand. And those that do, of course, will be kept under check in some way, because we aren't quite through this epic. We're halfway through it, but that halfway point indicates that we're going to succeed. That's what civilization has always been looking for, that December 21st, 2012. It means we will finally make it. So if we don't blow ourselves up before then, we're going to make it, Susan.
Okay, next stop, Santa Rosa, California. I'll be there this weekend. Hello, Angelo, go ahead.
Hello, this is Angelo. George, how are you doing, Christian?
Great.
Hi, Angelo.
Hey, I recently saw a video on YouTube called Climatica. It's much related to the subject you're speaking of tonight.
Okay.
I figured it would be nice to tell the people around the world about this. They might get a bit of insight. It also speaks of the ego, you say, is taking us over in this period of evolution. I think that might be the downfall of humanity.
Okay, you said ego, correct?
Yes.
Okay. This is very, very important. Thank you for bringing that up. The state of consciousness that changes is that we will stop using our ego. We're at a sense of a level of density, and that's what this whole phase of life is about right now. This density allows us to develop an ego, and that ego is what helps us create this sense of knowing. So mankind is at the stage right now where we have to know everything. And as we know things, then we develop our beliefs and are able to take those further. The next phase, of course, would take us out of the realm of ego. So we will literally be diminishing our ego as we go through this next phase. And that's sort of what we're marking. But we needed ego. We needed this phase in life in order to develop this sense of knowledge and knowing and to develop our own opinions, or we wouldn't be creative and wouldn't come up with answers that we're looking for, because we're going to need that when we merge it with the instincts of the Lemurian life that we had and the emotions of the Atlantean life. We got to put all those together in this new epic and make sense of it, and that new one is going to be about unity. But that unity isn't going to just be about human unity on the Earth. It's going to be about unity with other life in the entire universe. So something else that's interesting about where the ego would be situated in the consciousness level of mankind is it's in what we call the mental plane, because when we think, our thoughts actually don't exist here on the physical earth. They exist up in this place around heaven, which you call the mental plane. But it happens to be called the cosmic superhighway, which is a level of energy that allows us to communicate with life everywhere in the universe. It's the only level or pathway of energy that's consistent throughout the universe. So as we start going into that phase where it's natural for everyone to communicate at that level, we will, of course, be doing that. So we will be able to connect with life in other places. So we have now developed the awareness and the understanding and the compassion and the sensitivity. We are now fit, so to speak, to take our role as citizens of the universe. And so the ego has been important thus far, but that's what we're leaving right now. We'll be actually moving towards a higher realm of consciousness.
Are you excited about this date as we get closer to it, Christian?
Oh, gosh, am I excited, too. And, you know, I'm have a big calendar. I'm marking down the days because since I'm aware of these things, it's nice to know that we finally made it, too, because all of us, I should think everyone's concerned about our salvation, where we're going to go. Life goes on, and that's the purpose of life is to evolve up this rung, this ladder, so to speak, this endless spiral. But it takes a very, very long time, millions of years, not just thousands, as a lot of people think. It took a lot of effort to get us here. We actually had to evolve our consciousness through animals and plants before that and rocks. We've had an experience, not we as people, but our consciousness had to go through that first. And so this has all taken millions of years to get us to this phase. And so we're going to be past the halfway point, which means technically we've made it. So now we just have to experience what we've been developing so far. And so now we get to, it's like going to school all your life and then finally getting that job. Now we get to be the people we've been training ourselves to be.
Let's go to Fresno, California. Hello, John. You're up.
Hi, George. Just a great show tonight and a great show all week long.
Thank you,
probably the best on Coast to Coast I've heard. Christian, I have a question.
Sure, John.
A number of years ago, I was studying the Old Testament, the New Testament, and I found the references to time, times, and a half a time. And then in other places, it would say 3.5 years, other times 1,260 days, sometimes 42 months. But it's all the same length of time. And more recently, as I've become interested in 2012, I subtracted that out and came to June 21st of this year, the summer solstice, would be that 42 months times and a half a time. Well, that's getting pretty close. That time frame in the Old Testament, the New Testament, is always referred to as a time of catastrophe, of destruction, of political and sociological upheaval. It seems like we're getting close to that. The feeling I get is that I'm standing on the shore and the water has receded, and now here comes the wave. Well, June 21st is coming pretty close. I wondered what your thoughts were on that.
Well, the June 21st, well, let's talk about the timing in the Bible, first of all. The Christian Bible, of course, that's the newer religion, Christianity. It's only about 2,000 years old. Some of the others are 2,500, 4,500 years old. Christianity tends to use an enormous amount of metaphors in that book. So it's kind of hard to understand it without finding all the keys. But in your particular example, you are marking these solstices, which do indicate change. But the summer solstice is sort of a positive one, where the winter solstice would represent the more negative one, which is a death, so that we can proceed, follow with a rebirth. So the summer one would be sort of a rebirth. But it's also a change towards the positive. So the 621 will be a change for the positive. But as I mentioned before, these things that we're calling catastrophes is the way the superstitious mind, even back then, looked at these things. They're actually positive indicators that spiritual change is occurring as foretold. And with a limited point of view and limited reference on those that worked on the Bible and those books and things, they may harp on particular things for particular purposes. But I can assure you it's actually a positive sign.
Okay, let's take a couple more calls here. Let's go to Gerald in Little Rock, Arkansas. Hello,
hi, Gerald.
Hi.
I called to ask you, do you believe that Obama's plan to keep scientists from using the Hubble spacecraft to view the stars, do you think that reflects the Planet X? You know, Planet X kind of coincides with that calendar down there in Brazil, too.
Yeah, it can, and it's certainly part of the process because of the ancients also foretold of other planets, actually two other planets, and they will be part and parcel to this whole process also. I do believe the government actually is aware of what we're going to be, what we're calling Planet X. I believe they keep it under control, as they control a lot of things because they have to control the masses and our reaction to those things. But it isn't just the government. You know, the religions tend to control these things also because they have a vested interest in the way we believe. So I believe it would be great if we could use Hubble to view these things and prove it, and I think that's a tool that could do that. So I'm with you on that one.
Okay, let's go next to Pierre in Ontario, California, west of the Rockies. Good morning, Pierre.
Yeah, good morning. Good show. Thank you, George, for allowing me to talk with Dr. Christian. Well, I just want to ask him, you know, before I just ask him, it's so amazing to see, you know, people just take history from the Bible and also history from other book to make it together to see what could coming for the man, for the life of man. But, you know, I'm thinking, you know, because I studied the Bible for the past 25 years, and I, you know, from the Bible itself, you know, Jesus Christ says just on those four Gospels, which is Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, he says, you know, that when the Son of Man is going to come, it's going to be like the flood of Noah. And Noah, we all know, out of probably 50 million people that was living on the face of the earth.
Well, that's true. We've only got 30 seconds left, so I've got to cut you short, Pierre. And Christian, thank you for being on the program.
Certainly.
Whatever happens on this incredible moment of December 21st, 2012, we'll be here for it. And it's not too long away, is it?
It's not.
All right, Krishna, thanks so much for being on the program.
Thank you.
His website, mistoftheoracle.com. And our next Coast to Coast program, we'll talk about missing microbiologists and those who have passed on mysteriously. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Punnett and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.